Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never that debt is fraud. We beseech you to appeal unto heaven that we might be able to be successful. And probably one of the best ways to make that appeal is either initiating, well, personal prayer is always appropriate, but if you want to have a prayer circle or group prayer, then you can join Loudoun County, or I should say Loudoun Liberty, or you can create your own. But nevertheless, let's not leave any stone unturned when it comes to doing what is necessary. And so with that, again, your campaign begins today. Okay, so this means you need to really get engaged. Now, there's a lot of things I want to cover, but welcome back, Tammy.
And thank you.
I guess the one thing I wanted to ask, now that we've covered, in some ways, we kind of covered the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions twice, and then we dove into the Kentucky 1799 resolutions, Madison's report on the Virginia resolutions, and we just kind of skimmed through Madison's notes on nullification. What's your takeaway, having read that? Was there any real benefit of, you know, me, you know, twisting your arm and almost making it feel like it was going to break or something here? was there any other benefit other than me inflicting pain?
I mean, it's just very clear that nullification is not the answer.
There you go. That's one thing. Well, that's definitely out of the last document. But did it help you see? I mean, every citizen, I say this, I actually sometimes spend an entire show or a good portion of a show talking about the responsibility of a U.S. citizen. That we are required to support that Constitution and defend it. And if we don't do anything, even though it may not be our job and we may be busy doing other things, if we don't, you know, protect our self-governing system and keep and maintain our self-government, then who do we blame?
And we ourselves, of course.
That's right. And more importantly, if we fail, then we don't deserve to be citizens. In other words, everything hinges upon us. The power is in the people and their government. We have to hold them accountable, and then they have to hold the next government up accountable, and they have to hold the next government up accountable. So I was hoping in a little bit more verbose dialogue, what did you, you know, is there any lessons, anything that, oh, wow, this is what I got. Boom, boom, boom. Are you excited?
I don't know if excited is the word. I just feel like there's a lot of work that has to be done.
You know, at the risk of being failing to be politically correct. I'm just not unpolitically correct, but at the risk of failing to be politically correct and at a great risk of alienating and possibly insulting people, I want to talk about your feelings on what we read. At the risk of sounding like a woman or what have you. But I'm just trying to see if is there a benefit? Because I'm actually reading this material with other people. And, you know, you're the first to have, you know, having completed it, other than with Paul. And I will say that Paul was very, very verbose in how, you know, how eye-opening these documents were for him. Now, mm-hmm. I know everybody's different, and how we learn is a little bit different. Sometimes people need to put hands on. But anyway,
my feeling is that most every single person involved in any type of legislative work has no clue what they're doing. That's my real feeling.
Yeah, well, that's true. And they have no idea, you know, the power that they hold in a legislative position at the county and at the state of holding that next government above them in check. They've lost sight. This is the danger of a perpetual system. But it's the beauty of a perpetual system. If done right, it will preserve the framework and the limited government that it's supposed to have. In other words, we created, actually, we didn't create this. Our forefathers stood up against England. They revolted. They got themselves organized. They took their states back and created this confederation, and ultimately realized that, you know, before they capitulated and England do-si-do'd back into the Americas and took us over again, we woke up and we created a new form of government, which is this self-governing system. And so the state legislatures and the people involved in that process back then, they understood somewhat. I keep telling people, most people say these guys understood this completely. I'm telling you, they really didn't. Some of this stuff eluded them. And a lot of stuff eluded a lot of people. But those who really, you know, knew, even Madison, the father of the Constitution, I find, you know, that he didn't understand certain things. Because at that point in time, they couldn't fathom, you know, bringing, you know, actual foreign states into the Union. Mm-hmm. And we're at that point today where because of the, you know, our ability to communicate, our ability to be working together in such intimacy government-wise with the whole world, you know, they formed this UN and everything else, when really the U.S. Constitution, what they gave us was God's plan of creating a global government where liberty would be preserved instead of subjugating, you know, all of the people to this, you know, global government. So anyway.
Yeah, and it just feels like in, well, not just in my own, but all across the United States, you know, after realizing that most all of the things that they do have nothing to do with any of their enumerated powers, they're all just wasting a bunch of time and spinning their wheels. And so many of them want to keep that up because somehow that gives them power, I guess. I don't know.
Well, so, but it's corruption that is shared because the federal government corrupted itself and they started sharing their corruption and they realized that if they corrupt the states, they can even corrupt themselves more.
Yeah.
And eventually, you know, they got all the way down into the county governments and so forth to where there's no stone unturned where they haven't corrupted something. Corporations, I mean, everything. It's so.
Yeah, I was listening to a podcast this morning. Actually, it was Martha Lawley talking about the legislative session this time and how they, you know, they're going to talk about a supplemental budget. Uh-huh. She had a lot of good things to say, but one of the things that alarmed me was she said, you know, this year we don't always have excess, but this year we have excess. And so now we got to figure out what we're going to do with it.
And, you know, so let me actually dive into a conversation I had previous to this call or to this, not call, but to our recording here, I talked to Mike Lacoste out of Bremer County, Iowa. And I started working with him about a year ago. He and a lot of other people now have started really getting their, you know, their footing and getting ready to get organized. And so this is a great sign. And in talking to him, I realized that people, we're not putting context to what the heck's going on. Now, if you had your local government, you know, let's say your county. As a matter of fact, I'll give you, we'll speak in Wyoming's sense. Wyoming state legislature at the state level, they're spending millions of dollars on a fire help me out here. It's the gun firing range for a competition. Oh. And so they're spending millions of dollars on this facility, millions of dollars of the taxpayers' money. Now, near as I can tell, there's nowhere in the state constitution that allows them to spend money for public entertainment or to build a business.
Yeah.
And yet they're doing this because they're saying, well, this will bring people in. But actually, is there any plan out of that money spent? Is there any plan of this facility paying the state or the people back?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that.
I'm not seeing it. And the bottom line is, you know, it would be wonderful to have that firing range there, but wouldn't it be equally wonderful to build a Disneyland in Wyoming as well?
Yeah.
And, you know, that way we could have, you know, all this great entertainment and all, you know, something to do in Wyoming. But near as I can tell, that's not the responsibility of your state legislature. This goes back to this position I've been trying to help people use on what is moral and immoral regarding doing something you're not supposed to do. Oh, well, this is a moral thing. That's good. Let's look at the other way. What would you say if the state legislature was opening up brothels throughout the state?
I mean, I would hope everybody would say that that's not a good thing.
But the point is, it's not about whether it's a moral thing or not. Yeah, in other words,
it's about whether they have the enumerated power to do it.
There you go. Because when you look at the morality, immorality side, there are two sides of the same coin, right? We want to do we want to spend money. We want to spend your money on moral entertainment. Oh, no. We'd rather spend your money on immoral entertainment. They shouldn't be spending the money. They shouldn't even be having these conversations. Where do you get the authority and the power to spend our money on these things?
Hence, going back to wasting a lot of time and spinning their wheels things they shouldn't even be talking about.
So, yeah, there you go. So until the people start holding their public servants accountable to the Constitution instead of to their moral platitudes, we're going to be tossed to and fro. And as long as we go in and argue on the position of morality, this is an immoral thing to do, you will lose the argument every time. If you go in and argue, where do you have the authority to do what you're doing?
Yeah.
That way, you're literally changing the argument to say, it's not whether it's moral or immoral. You don't have the authority to do it.
Yeah.
Folks, that's how we win. So what we've done is we've kind of covered, and actually we talked a lot about trying to get into the Organic Act, right? By the end of the year I wanted to do that, but guess what? Today is the second to the last show of the year. And I'm sure everybody's had a very Merry Christmas. But bottom line, my next show is actually going to be after the New Year's, and our next show, I should say, which would be the first. And actually not the first, the second, which would be a week from today. And so there's just no time. And had I actually, because next, on Christmas Eve, next week, or actually... I'm sorry, as we did on Tuesday, I did a Christmas show, and I replayed that on Christmas Day. And on New Year's Eve, I play the show that talks about how to set effective goals. Now, folks, if you want to know how to succeed, you have to know how to plan and how to execute a plan. Whatever it is you do, you have to execute a plan. I mean, you can meander through life. And if you're complaining that you're just not successful at what you do, then whose fault is that? Is it because people are frustrating you and constantly intervening? Or are you just failed to be focused on your plan? And so this is how people actually, when you look at people like Trump, these billionaires and so forth, they did not allow themselves to be distracted from their plan. They focused on their plan. Because life can come at you, and they can always throw a curveball every day. Oh, well, it's so nice. Let's go fishing instead. Mm-hmm. And so the temptation of getting away from the plan. So today what we're going to do as the follow-up to Christmas is, and I think that the lesson in this one article, actually it's an essay by James Madison called Property. He wrote this in 1792, and I don't think you've ever read this with me before. Uh-huh. And so he's going to kind of point out some things. Now, what we're going to do on the second, actually, is my show of the Toriax. And so as I'm kind of looking for the concept, or I should say, I just want to look at the calendar. I want to make sure I'm right on this because, yeah, we won't have a show until the 6th, or actually the 7th. And so we're not going to be able to cover the Organic Act until that week. But there's one more article that we need to dive into, and that is the letter from John G. Jackson. So we were going to – you got that? Do you have the John G. letter? James Madison's letter to John G. Jackson. Instead of reading this property essay, we'll do this on Tuesday, the 7th. And what we'll do is we'll read this letter from John G. Jackson on, I'll set it all up, but go ahead and open that up. And when you've got it, let me know.
So James Madison to John?
Yes, a letter from James Madison to John G. Jackson, yeah. When you've got that. Okay, so this letter was written in 1821. You can see it was December, it was the end of the year. And prior to this, and as a matter of fact, in Monroe's inaugural address in 2020, which was his second term, this is where Monroe basically communicated to the people that the United States was well on track of, shedding its debt to the wars, the wars that it faced. So, in other words, the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812, the debt for those, they were well on track to seeing those paid off. Wow. Do you understand what I just said? They were actually, the United States government was going to be out of debt. And the majority of its revenue was really coming more from imposts because America, its commerce and everything else really started thriving because Britain was no longer harassing and we didn't have to, go out with extra ships and, taking resources to protect our commerce. We could now actually engage in commerce without spending a penny, which is what the world does today because the United States has a Navy out there protecting the flow of commerce, which is, I think, is morally wrong. Every nation that's been benefiting off the United States, it needs to be communicated. If they're not flying an American flag, go take it. We don't care. And we don't want to be thugs, like a gang would do. They would come in and say, hey, if you want protection, you need to pay us. What do I need protection from? And then the gang busts up your store and says things like that. Mm-hmm. That's a great way of marketing. But anyway, so setting the stage here, in Monroe's second inaugural address, he said that the nation was putting on, getting on top of its debt, and in the near future, and we actualized this under Jackson. Everybody gives Jackson the credit for paying off the debt. He didn't. This was a plan Madison and him put in at the very end of Madison's presidency to basically pay off that debt. It's the same thing as the repatriating of black freemen back to Africa. Most people don't even know that this happened. As a matter of fact, the idea really came from Thomas Jefferson, because Thomas Jefferson realized, he made a comment, and I think it was prior to the Constitution, when he was talking about slavery, he said, "We hold the wolf by the ear." He's talking about slavery. "We can no longer hold it safely, nor let it go." In other words, if we let it go, then where is it going to go? So he came up with, and he proposed a plan under his presidency to actually take the freemen and send them back to Africa, to repatriate them to Africa. But he just couldn't do that because he would be taking these people, unguarded and what have you, these freemen, and putting them into Africa, as vulnerable to be caught up and put back into the slave trade.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they ended up doing was they ended up buying a parcel of land in Africa. It's called Liberia, standing for liberty. And the capital is called Monrovia, after James Monroe. Because Monroe was the one that actualized the plan in getting that land for them and getting them onto ships. Because, again, we had just signed the treaty. When Madison was stepping down, it takes a little while with driving a big ship like the United States government. It takes a while to get, you know, things settled and things in motion, because it was really a part-time government. It wasn't working full-time. Everybody was at home like they should be, growing their own crops or doing their own thing, because they weren't making a lot of money. There was no retirement plan for a public servant, nor is there still to this day in the Constitution. There is no allowance for, because we covered this. Okay, so as we're looking, all of a sudden, as they started engaging and doing things prior to, and as this was the beginning, the 1820s was the beginning of Manifest Destiny. It hadn't attained the name, quote unquote, Manifest Destiny. But all of a sudden, since we didn't have the encumbrance of the British, you know, harassments and so forth, it really made it look like America was really going to start being able to move west and start, you know, making this a large nation. And the move was on to actually start setting up more and more states. And the Missouri Compromise was a part of that, because those who were in affluence of the slave states, we have covered this a lot, but they basically knew that Missouri was not going to actually choose to be a slave state. All of the textbooks and all of the history books that we read will tell us that Missouri wanted to be a slave state, but I ask you this one question. Why did they need the federal government to create the Missouri Compromise and force it to be a slave state if it was going to be a slave state? And so they wanted to start there because they wanted to make sure that not only Missouri would become a slave state, but every state south of the Mason-Dixon line would be forced to be a slave state. Now, this was really repugnant to the good people of Virginia. And Madison had a lot of friends, and his wife, Dolly Madison, had a lot more friends. I mean, she was a real socialite, and she was, you know, she was the one that helped him become more of a publicly pleasing man, because he was a very recluse person, very focused on learning. He was kind of a nerd and a wonk, whatever. But as Monroe was dealing with some of these cases, and he failed to stand up regarding this thing called the Missouri Compromise and other cases that were starting to come out of the court, these men, so we're going into break now, so these men actually had a real problem. These men looked at what was going on, and they say, you know what, this does not reflect what we see the Constitution in limiting government to be able to do. And so they really questioned whether they could be doing all of these things. And so they had a question for Madison. So when we come back, I'll dive into that fundamental question. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so believe it or not, these men knew and was able to approach this very approachable man called James Madison. He was already dubbed the father of the Constitution. And so when we kind of look at the situation at hand, they were absolutely dumbfounded that government and the courts were making decisions, and they go, this does not resemble what we think a limited and defined government, the one that Madison and Jefferson ran and acted in their presidencies. We're seeing things that are different, so, which basically helps speak to Monroe's inability to actually hold back corruption. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so Monroe was doing good things. And as a matter of fact, in 1822, he vetoed Congress's attempt to create the Department of Transportation. So there were some things he was getting right, but he was missing some stuff. Because I think maybe he just wanted to please people. I don't know. But these men, John G. Jackson was the spokesperson for a group of men. And it was his intent, their intent, to get Madison to publish his notes, because this is one of the things that everybody knew, that Madison had these notes on the Constitutional Convention. And so they appealed to John G. Jackson to say, please give us your notes so that we can, by reading them, we can understand their true intent within the Constitution, what these clauses and words mean. And so this letter is Madison's reply to that request. And so let's go ahead. It's from Mount Pilliar, December 27th, 1821. Go ahead.
With respect to that portion of the Mass which contains the voluminous proceedings of the Convention, it has always been my intention that they should someday or other see the light. But I have always felt it was... Hold on, I lost my place. I have always felt at the same time the delicacy attending such a use of them, especially at an early season. In general, I have learned to the expediency of letting the publication be a posthumous one.
Posthumous, right. So in other words, they were going to be, you know, published after he passed.
Okay. The result of my latest reflections on the subject, I cannot more conveniently explain than by the enclosed extract from a letter confidentially written since the appearance of the proceeding of the convention, as taken from the notes of Chief Justice Yates.
Okay, so it was his intent to hold on to these things and not publish them until, and actually it was his plan to publish these so that they would sell and Dolly Madison would be supported financially by the sale of this book. And it didn't do as well as he thought. And I think that's because, you know, everybody was haze gray and underway. They were all happy. Hey, that's a Navy, you know, business as usual type of thing. And so when we look at this, you know, these documents, people didn't care to understand the Constitution because everything, you know, they didn't see any threats. they didn't recognize they didn't recognize what was happening were literally bad things, and there was incrementally happening, and nobody recognized it. They were the frogs in the pot. America was just a bunch of frogs in the pot that did not notice that the heat actually, hey, it got a little warmer. So I'm feeling a little better. And so, boy, it kind of takes the kinks out of the old joints. Anyway, now he's going to go into his comments regarding Yates and what he says. So go ahead.
With this work, I have not yet seen a copy. From the scraps thrown into the newspapers, I cannot doubt that the prejudices of the author guided his pen and that he has committed egregious errors, at least in relation to others as well as to myself.
Okay, so in other words, the stuff that he saw coming out of Yates's notes, he said that this guy, you know, his obviously his prejudices were guiding exactly how he wanted to speak to what happened. Madison, in his notes, they were very objective. You could still see, you know, his own prejudices, because having read them, I can see them. But they're only in context to, you know, his thoughts on, but he actually covers what they did and does provide. So you can kind of, it's easy to find out, you know, to see the spots where he's editorializing or kind of giving some commentary. But for the most part, he's trying to convey what was being said, not necessarily why. And so, okay, keep going.
That most of us carried into the convention. Hold on. That most of us carried into the convention a profound impression produced by the experience and inadequacy of the old Confederation, and by the monetary examples of all similar ones, ancient and modern, as to the necessity of binding the states together by a strong constitution is certain. The necessity of such a constitution was enforced by the gross, disreputable inequalities which had been prominent in the internal administrations of most of the states. Nor was the recent and alarming insurrection headed by
the Shays
in Massachusetts without a very sensible effect on the publication?
On the public mind. Yeah, public mind. Basically what he's saying is that Shay rebellion was, you know, it had a big effect, and it helped start waking people up that we couldn't stay the course. Okay, so go ahead.
Such indeed was the aspect of things that in the eye of all the best friends of liberty, a crisis had arrived which was to decide whether
The American experiment
was to be a blessing to the world or to blast forever the hopes which the Republican cause had inspired.
Right. Folks, there are some abbreviations that will, you know, what? Because who knew what AMN meant?
Yeah.
Okay.
And what is not to be overlooked, the disposition to give a new system all the vigor consistent with Republican principles was not a little simulated by a backwardness in some quarters towards a convention for the purpose which was ascribed to a secret dislike to popular government and a hope that delay would bring it more into disgrace and pave the way for a form of government more congenial with monarchical or aristocratical
predilections.
Right,
so that's kind of underlined. What he's really saying is that, you know, here we kind of moved into this, you know, this convention with these vigorous principles. And they basically said, you know, we went in there to do this. And he points out that not a little were stimulated by the backwardness in some quarters towards a convention for the purpose. And so which he continues saying was ascribed to a secret dislike of popular government. In other words, in creating this government, there were people that were very against this. And he actually says, and they hoped that a delay would bring it more into disgrace and pave the way for a form of government more congenial with a monarchical or aristocratical predilections. In other words, there were people that were involved. Guess who was one of those people?
Madison? I don't know.
No, not Madison. Madison's talking here. He was basically identified that some of the people he was working with actually had more of a monarchical you know, desire than a Republican form of government. Hamilton was one of them. Hamilton gave all the lip service of moving this forward, and then he basically, you know, threw everything out the window as soon as it was ratified, empowering the courts to do things that they had no authority under the Constitution to do, as well as, you know, start implying powers. In other words, the Constitution literally became a victim of Madison's cunning because of what he was doing with the courts and implying powers and so forth. Okay, so let's go into this next.
His view of the crisis made it natural for many of the convention, many in the convention, to learn more.
To lean more
than was perhaps in strictness warranted by a proper distinction between causes temporary, as some of them doubtless were, and causes permanently inherent in popular frames of government. It is true also, as has been sometimes suggested, that in the course of discussions in the convention, where so much depended on compromise, the patrons of different opinions often set out on negotiating grounds more remote from each other than the real opinions of either or from the point at which they finally met.
Okay, so in other words, people actually used bargaining tactics to go way out there so that as they compromised, they would compromise closer to where they were. Right? In other words, you know, oh, well, this is really going to hurt us. We, you know, and they were using hyperbole to basically, you know, I call it the dramatic effect. Oh, you know, we're going to die here. You know, you got to throw us some bones because that's what they're looking for. They're looking for some serious compromises, which they already have that when they got them or they got closer to them, like the slavery issue. That was one of those points that Madison's talking about. So, okay, so keep going.
For myself, having from the first moment of maturing a political opinion down to the present one, never ceased to be a votary of the principle of self-government, I was among those most anxious to rescue it from the danger which seemed to threaten it. With that view, was willing to give to a government resting on that foundation as much energy as would ensure the requisite stability and efficacy. It is possible that in some instances this consideration may have been allowed a weight greater than subsequent reflection within the convention or the actual operation of the government that of the government would sanction. It may be remarked also that it sometimes happened that opinions as to the particular modifications or a particular power of the government had a conditional reference to others which, combined therewith, would vary the character of the whole.
Okay, so as Madison was pointing out, that as he was maturing and learning and becoming more understanding, becoming more wise to the political processes, you know, he basically became a big supporter of self-government. That's what he meant there. Ceased to be a votary, a huge supporter, a champion of the principles of self-government. I was among those most anxious to rescue it from the danger which seemed to be to threaten it, because they were looking to try to create a centralized government. Now, here's the interesting thing. When Madison started off, and this is what this is why Hamilton, you know, zoned in on him, was during the Annapolis convention or the meeting in Annapolis, where they said, we have to have a convention to rewrite the Articles of Confederation. And so Madison proposed right after that his plan of a very powerful centralized government. And this is, like I said, this is what brought Hamilton to him, because that was not a self-governing system. What Madison originally proposed was a very centralized, central-powered, you know, national government, and it was rejected. And as a matter of fact, it was, as he went through the debates, his eyes opened up as a more proper government really started coming out of the compromises, out of the divine hand of providence, inspiring them to, you know, to swing other ways. And while these arguments, you know, became so profound, he really started becoming, that's when he became this real champion of a self-governing system under this Republican banner. And so he then again points to, you know, there were these people that had this, you know, bad character that they wanted to kind of go down this other way. And so this is what he says basically in response. And this is where he really answers John G. Jackson. Go ahead. This is highlighted, folks.
Okay. But whatever might have been the opinions entertained in forming the Constitution, it was the duty of all to support it in its true meaning as understood by the nation at the time of its ratification.
Okay, so what does that mean? What did he just say there? He said it didn't matter what we thought. It didn't matter anybody in that convention what we thought. What we thought does not matter. In other words, he just downplayed and popped the bubble of him trying to sell this posthumous work of the notes. In other words, they don't matter. I mean, they might be insightful, that you might find something out of them, but they don't matter. What matters? What matters when it comes to understanding the Constitution? What is the only thing that matters here?
To support it as they understood it.
Well, so I'm talking about documentation. What documentation is the only documentation that matters when it comes to understanding the Constitution? Let me read this part. It was the duty of all to support it in its true meaning as understood by this nation at the time of its ratification. What documents is he talking about?
The ratification debates.
There you go. In other words, if you want to understand the Constitution, it doesn't matter if you read the notes, because that doesn't apply. I mean, it helps you understand some doctrines and so forth, but it really doesn't apply to what the Constitution means. In contract law, the only thing that's important is how the parties, the person that was ratified, the people that were buying into this, how it was stipulated. In other words, how did they sell this? When you go to, and if you've ever gone to, because I know a lot of people probably heard this, when you go to a timeshare, you know, you go to a timeshare, you go to a nice hotel, it's practically free as long as you go and listen to their sales job on, you know, getting and investing into a timeshare. And so you can have a, you know, you could share places like this. And so what they do is they sell it to you. And as they do that, they're kind of stipulating in general terms, pointing to the contract. But regardless, when you are sitting there and you're buying into something, however they stipulate it verbally, is one of those things that you can hold binding. It's legally binding. As I've said many times before, if I'm selling you a car and I stipulate that as long as you own that car, you can bring it into our dealership and wash it and wax it once a week. Now, that's probably a $50, $60 savings out of your pocket on a weekly basis. In other words, you'd be a fool not to take that deal. And so when you come in, because I stipulated it, legally I got to give it to you. But if you can't prove that I stipulated it when you come in and I say, oh, shoot, we didn't put that down in the contract, now you realize you've been duped. Well, of have you? Technically, if there's witnesses or anybody that could actually prove the veracity that that was stipulated, then it's done. They are going to be on the hook. And I would never sell that car. Even if it was broken down, I would get a tow truck and have that car towed to have them wash and wax it, and then I tow it back home. I wouldn't get a tow truck because that would be more defeating. But I would, you know, tow it by my own truck. I'd go buy a truck just so I could tow it. Because that becomes a huge savings for you weekly, right? I mean, that's a few hundred dollars a month. And if you add that up over, you know, the lifespan, that can actually add up to be a lot. And it would. The interesting thing is that many times when it's stated, the problem is it wasn't written down. You know, the beautiful thing about this Constitution is that every word that was stated, for the most part, there were points in time where they couldn't hear it, where they basically had to say Madison mumbled or spoke so softly we couldn't hear. So those words don't, you know, aren't present. But everything else was written down. Do you think the divine hand of providence knew that we may need these documents down the road to actually help us understand what that Constitution means?
Yeah.
Just to make the connections for people, because you hear me say this all the time, that only he knew what we would be facing. He knew he needed to provide us with these ratification debates so that we could break free from our corrupt government. He gave us everything we needed, the Constitution itself and the ratification debates. Do you think that's a coincidence? Understanding contract law has basically maintained these tenets and standards from the very beginning. I mean, doesn't our Creator work with contracts? I mean, isn't a covenant the same thing? You commit to doing something, he commits to doing something, you do these things, he'll bless you. Right? Yeah. And so you see how, you know, there are these covenants or these compacts, and he knew the game. I wouldn't even say the game. He knew the plan. And he knew what we would need. And this flies in the face because I've been lately trying to help people understand that when you hear people say that this Constitution was only for a righteous people, I honestly believe that's an insult to our Creator, because he knew how evil this nation would become and how evil the world would become. And do you think he gave us all of this stuff because we were going to maintain righteousness? No. He gave us this stuff because he knew we would be falling. He knew that we would get to a point where we would be at critical mass, where we would not have, on righteousness, we would not have a leg to stand to recover our liberties with righteousness. But with a contract and holding to contract law, people that still enjoy liberty, that may not care too much about their salvation, but they do want their rights. They want to be free. This is innate in every person. I do not know any person that says, well, feed me my dinner, whatever it's going to be, I'll eat it. You know, hand out, you know, give me the clothes I have to wear tomorrow. You know, everybody wants to have a choice. As a matter of fact, I know that there are some people that struggle. They'd rather have a uniform, but they don't have to worry about what am I going to wear. That's usually guys, but I'm sorry to say that. But the reality is everybody wants a choice. Everybody wants to choose what car they drive. You think the people are happy in the, you know, early days of the Russian regime of the, you know, the awakening of industries where cars were being built and the whole world had a variety of cars, but they had the Yugo. You know, everybody had a really crappy car because that's what the state made.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody wants a choice, but when you live in those places that don't give you freedom of choice, then you go, wow, I mean, I realize what I'm missing. But today, people don't know what they will be missing as we surrender more and more of what we've got. I'm hoping that people really start seeing the big picture here, that this truly is the direction that we have to go. This, he's laid out all the breadcrumbs. When you take all these documents and this comment right here, it actually proves that we can hold every public servant accountable to the Constitution because we have precisely how they sold it, precisely how they justified this Constitution so that it would be ratified. This is powerful stuff. And anybody that doesn't see this is absolutely doing America and themselves a disservice. So let's go ahead and wrap this up.
Okay. No one felt this obligation more than I have done, and there are few perhaps whose ultimate and deliberate opinions on the merits of the Constitution accord in a greater degree with that obligation.
In other words, he's really pointing out that he's like one of the only people that has kind of understood this. This helps support my point that really Madison was probably the only guy that really understood the Constitution, and he still didn't see some of the stuff that the Lord, you know, put into it because he never thought of those things and how the world was going to change. So go ahead.
The departures from the true and fair construction of the instrument have always given me pain and always experienced my opposition when called for. The attempts in the outset of the government to defeat those safe, if not necessary, and those politic, if not obligatory, amendments introduced in conformity to the known desires of the body of the people and to the pledges of many, particularly myself, when vindicating and recommending the Constitution, was an occurrence not a little ominous. And it was soon followed by indications of political tenets and by rules, or rather the abandonment of all rules of expounding it, which were capable of transforming it into something very different from its legitimate character as the offspring of the national will.
Right.
I wish I could say that constructive innovations had altogether ceased.
And they haven't. He wished he could say it, but they haven't. Whether the Constitution, as it has divided the powers of government between the states in their separate and in their united capacities, tends to an aggressive aggrandizement of the general government or to an anarchical independence of the state governments, is a problem which time alone can absolutely determine. So I'm going to ask you, out of this, what happened? Did we move towards an anarchical independent states, or did we move towards an aggrandizement of the general government?
Aggrandizement.
Absolutely. The general government started, and they learned how to corrupt the states and get them to do their bidding. All it took was printing money. It would be much wished with, I'll go ahead and finish the last of this. It is much to be wished that the division as it exists, or as it may be made with regular sanction of the people, may effectually guard against both extremes. In other words, folks, we have to be the ones doing this. For it cannot be doubted that an accumulation of all power in the general government would as naturally lead to a dangerous accumulation in the executive hands as that the resumption of all power by the several states would end in the calamities incident to the contiguous and rival sovereigns, to say nothing of its effect in lessening the security for sound principles of administration for them. Now, I think he goes in here and he kind of basically starts talking a little bit more of, you know, pontification and so forth. So we're out of time. We've covered the meat of this. We don't have to really cover the rest because it ends in concept. It ends with, you know, some personal notes back to John G. Jackson. And so we really covered the nuts and bolts that you need to hear, folks. You need to read this, and you need to really start putting everything together that we've given you. This right here seals the deal. And so the question is, what is it going to take to get you involved? I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.